This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana. Well, if you've been listening for a while, you'd know that up until a couple years ago, I was very much a free market anarchist, a voluntarist, and most of my life a libertarian who was socially liberal, fiscally conservative, as I would say. And I'm sure many of you have been down that road. But we change as our experience and truth expands. I too thought that voluntary society that respected the non-aggression principle would be the ideal society. But then I woke up to cultural Marxism, the blatant war on whites, and the plan to flood all European countries with non-whites as a way to destroy our unity, our culture, and our way of life. I woke up to white genocide and all the ugliness that comes with it. Libertarianism and anarchism is still a utopian idea, and when you're in a war, utopian ideas get you killed. Am I against our current government? Yes, of course. But libertarianism and anarchism is not presenting real tactics to crush the beast that is our government. Returning back to the Constitution is also a lost cause. Travel around America. See how it has changed in a rapid amount of time. Newcomers don't give a damn about the Constitution or your forefathers because we are undergoing neo-colonization. So how would voluntarism work then? Although it was Europeans who created America, it was not founded based on an ancestral basis, but based on an ideology. Historically, countries founded on ideology rather than DNA fail, and so will America. So here we are revisiting a subject I felt strongly about a couple years ago. My guest Connor Boyack has been featured regularly on mainstream shows. He's the founder of the Libertas Institute, a free market think tank in Utah. He is the author of several books, including Feardom, on how politicians use fear-mongering to acquire more power. I realize there are different types of libertarians, and some favor national borders, but most don't. Listen to what Connor has to say. How does this subject fit with you today? Welcome to the young and prolific Connor. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I wanted to discuss your book, Feardom, How Politicians Exploit Our Emotions. But first, share with us your political leanings, because as far as I understand, you went from libertarian to anarchist, correct?
The progression perhaps was broader than that. You know, I was brought up in a generally conservative household, although I didn't really know what that meant. To this day, I don't know what a conservative is. And every time I ask a conservative what a conservative is, they don't really have a good answer.
Conservative?
They don't even know. That's the problem. I ended up becoming kind of a constitutionalist after kind of studying American history and thinking that, you know, the Constitution was the bee's knees, but quickly realized that constitutionalists don't have an answer for local government. They're all about the federal government, and many of the constitutionalists I met supported all sorts of local tyranny. And so I realized that that was not a good philosophical framework. Ended up, of course, after that in libertarianism, but people always ask, what's the difference between a libertarian and an anarchist? And the running joke is, you know, 4 months, just a little bit of time, and you end up that way. And I don't call myself that just because of the stigma and everything.
Sure,
I use voluntarist. I love that this utopian notion of a voluntary, you know, civil society, and that's kind of what I kind of brand it as. But yeah, just this belief that we need cooperation and voluntarism, not ideas so good they're meant to be implemented by force.
That's right. Well, you clearly understand the war on family, probably the war on whites, cultural Marxism, and then there's this insane, this puritanical left, which is pushing for all sorts of government policies and hate speech, favoring some groups over others. But from your view, what's the best tactic to crush this leftist tyranny?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd have to say context, right? Because that's what the so-called left always fails to provide. They always have this very mangled view, outlook of the world. Whenever it's a, you know, media on MSNBC, not that the right is immune to this by any means, but since we're talking about this very concerted effort that the left has waged, you know, I think it's often without context. They aren't looking at that, okay, all of these things are happening, some of them are bad, but what does that look like in the context of history? What does it look like in the context of what liberals themselves are supporting on other issues? And I think it's a problem more generally with the public, and a lot of the work that I do with public interest policy, there's a lot of seemingly lack of awareness about things other than what is being presented in the very initial conversation. So no one asks questions, they don't really study the broader issues, and so the entire conversation becomes this very narrow spectrum of the information that's provided to the individual. And unless we kind of take a step back, look at the 10,000 foot view and try and understand, you know, the big picture, the context, we're really just kind of going down this path that's being almost manufactured for us, where, you know, if I give you choice A and choice B, but I don't tell you about choice C, clearly I've controlled you to a certain extent and I can shape the outcome of what we're going to do. And I think that, especially with the help of the media, that's what we see so often unraveling with this plan that you mentioned.
Yeah, I just wonder how far this is going to go if we don't push back at some point.
Sky's the limit, I guess.
Yeah, I'd like to see a lot of, I know a lot of anarchists, they say they're beyond the left and right, but unfortunately everything kind of gets polarized into left and right. So I'd like to see many groups maybe aligning to smash some of this leftist tyranny, because is anarchism strong enough to push back?
Well, I think how anarchism can best succeed, or rather how this voluntary society can be achieved, is by making friends. My biggest concern with the liberty movement generally is that you get the Puritans who basically try and alienate anyone who's not as pure as they are, right? And, oh, you're only 80% anarchist, or you're only 75% libertarian or whatever. You're not good enough. I totally disagree with you. Therefore, I'm just going to not associate with you at all. And in the course of my work, we've had the opportunity to work with people I disagree with strongly on some issues, and I think are just doing some things that I can't stand, I think are totally wrongheaded. And yet on policies where we agree, we can join forces, and it not only does it help facilitate common goals and we can work towards common objectives, but also it builds a relationship that can be used to persuade and educate and nurture that relationship down the road, so that when it's what's that saying that people don't care what you know until they know how much you care? I think we need to be friendly. I think there's something to be said about trying to put into practice what we preach. And if we think that our ideas are the method to human prosperity and happiness, let's not be grumpy. Let's not be alienating. Let's not just criticize everybody. Yes, there's problems, but let's be positive. Let's be happy. Let's be willing to work together with one another and expose others to our ideas rather than drawing all these walls around one another. It's something I really can't stand. And whether anarchism or libertarianism more generally, it seems that people are just bitter or totally disinterested towards those with whom they disagree to any degree.
Well, it seems Mormons to me, they're more anarchist and self-reliant. They seem like they're against the state in a lot of ways. They're industrious, creating businesses. They take care of each other, almost like their own welfare state. And they even are kind of separatist by claiming an area to preserve your way of life. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that from an outside view, you can see some of the things that you just mentioned. In fact, that was a very good list and good characterization from an outside view as to how Mormons or Latter-day Saints could be perceived, and how some of these outcomes that are a byproduct of our theology could be perceived as philosophically aligned or aligned based on outcome with anarchism. But if you talk to the average Mormon, not only would they not understand what anarchism is or voluntarism, but they would have this visceral reaction to it if you explain it to them. Most Latter-day Saints are very supportive of the Constitution. They believe it was divinely inspired of God. And so they become statists, but probably more minarchists, right? They're willing to tolerate a government. Of course, we have we have Harry Reid, and we have Mitt Romney, and we have, everyone in between, myself being a voluntarist as well. So there's a wide spectrum. But by and large, I would say Mormons are supportive of the state, especially increasingly so in recent decades, where there's been a lot more willingness to vote for social democratic policies and just go along with the status quo. But if you look at kind of the fundamentals, the theology, and even still some of the outcomes, I think it is fair to say that there is a lot of alignment. I've written a book basically on that exact thing, arguing for the points that you actually mentioned. And so I think it kind of depends. I think we need to shift the needle back to where it used to be. I think in recent decades, we've actually, as a church membership, gone in the wrong direction.
Well, another thing, there's a lot of anti-statists, and they don't seem to be bothered with this forced mass immigration and multiculturalism, even though this is really government created. They're making these problems happen. So some of these people just say, but countries are just imaginary lines. Yet we know borders and boundaries, they've existed for thousands of years, and there's cultures within those boundaries. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I actually favor open immigration from a property rights standpoint. I think one of the biggest problems we have today is with this notion of collectivism, of public property, where people have the right to regulate one another. We're dealing with a lot of policies in Utah right now where voters are trying to use zoning ordinances as a basically a weapon against their neighbors to say, no, I don't think you should be able to build a shed or have weeds taller than 3 inches, or I don't think that this landowner should be able to develop it into a commercial building. I think we've gotten to the point where people are comfortable using the law to dictate to other people how they can use their property. I've lived in Honduras for a couple of years, about a decade ago. I have many friends down there. It's in Central America. And I would love the opportunity to provide, I would love to provide an opportunity for some of my friends to come live in our basement maybe for a period of time and work for me or for another business owner friend of mine to expand their network, expand their cultural awareness and horizons, you know, have that opportunity. And yet they can't, even though it would be strictly, you know, private property. Of course, the roads is always the ultimate argument that we talk about. But I don't agree with this conception that the existence of borders justifies the collective, justifies the majority in being able to say, you know what, you have to go through this procedure, you have to get the government's permission. I think borders are jurisdictional. They denote the boundaries around which a certain government operates, but they don't necessarily confer any authority that the residents within those borders themselves do or don't have. You have to first have that authority. And just like I can't tell my neighbor that, hey, you can't let this, you know, Colombian live with you guys or go work for your business, I don't think we can delegate that right to the government. I think our immigration policies are totally upside down. And even those who will concede, oh yeah, you know, we need to streamline immigration, we need to fix it, everyone recognizes that's the problem. But deep down inside, there are very few who are willing to go towards the laissez-faire policy that we had for the first century in America, which was basically open borders to a large extent. And I think freedom and property rights and markets and everything else dictate that we need to get back to that point if we're going to have any sanity anytime soon on this issue.
Well, my issue here too is that then what happens is, let's say there's a group of Europeans who are separatists and they say, no, we want to go do something different here. They're not allowed to do it. The government will actually go chase them down and prevent them from doing something like that.
Yeah. And it's, of course, a problem with a welfare state, right? Where that's the biggest argument is many people will even concede, oh, yeah, we want freer immigration, but we simply can't have it with a welfare state right now. And so, therefore, because we have a welfare state, we're going to justify this micromanagerial immigration regime. And you know, I think the skeptics among us might say that, well, maybe increasing immigration and saturating things in America might finally be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and we can start to scale down the welfare policy. But certainly, if we're just handing away government goodies to anyone who shows up,
well, that's right. Then
they
all want to come because of the money. So if the government wasn't involved, I think most of these people wouldn't, because most people want to be around their own folk, their own culture, their own blood and soil. And if it was anarchist, I think there would be, people would actually be fighting, you know, like the good old days. You fight and create those boundaries and you make that happen. You don't just sit down and just surrender, you know?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, we need to get to a point where people are encouraged, if not required, to have personal responsibility. I mean, if we didn't have a welfare state, if you had to look out for yourself and your family, you'd naturally be inclined to find, you know, locations, markets, job opportunities where you could do that. You wouldn't, your first prerogative wouldn't be to find where you can get, you know, food stamps or free education or healthcare. And it's these policies that really blur the lines and prevent people from making those moral choices, because suddenly they're incentivized to do the opposite. And I think the large part is these incentives that exist that prevent people from even giving consideration to personal responsibility, as important as it is.
Well, speaking of private property, is Utah also going to be feeling the brunt of this HUD or fair housing? Because, you know, Utah zip codes, it's a bit too white, Connor.
Yeah, I don't know how many, other people would want to move into, you know, this type of environment. Utah's beautiful. Of course, it is homogenous from an outsider's perspective in many ways. Yeah, I don't know. We haven't really seen that issue playing out that much, but especially with the big social justice agenda of the left, you really do see this push for equalization, you know, in education, in employment, certainly in housing. And we haven't really seen that happen too much in Utah, but I wouldn't expect not to see it in the future.
So what are your thoughts on like egalitarianism and hate speech that's coming in full force? What do you think about this?
It's interesting as a libertarian, when I'm asked my opinion on any given policy, it becomes pretty easy, right? Because you take it down to the fundamental question of, would I have the right to, you know, use violence or coercion against my neighbor to implement or enforce policy X? And, you know, I'm often asked in the course of my work, you know, with Libertas Institute, what's your position on this, that, and the other? And I think it's interesting to see the reactions that I get where people are surprised at how quickly I can respond to that, because ultimately it just has to pass the gut check test. In my mind, the only exercise I'm doing is, would I feel comfortable and morally justified if I did this to my neighbor or if my neighbor did this to me? And it's amazing how many of these issues just dissolve when you put them up against that test. You know, with egalitarianism and equality and all this kind of stuff, this notion of social justice, it's basically simply using the government as a vehicle to pursue ends that a subset of the population desires. And whether it's Republican or Democrat, whether it's, you know, the pro-crony business or egalitarian or whatever, I kind of cynically call elections a political popularity contest, right? This is just people trying to wrest control of the power of government to enforce their views on the dissenting minority. And at the end of the day, I don't understand how any sane person sees that as something viable, as something praiseworthy or beneficial, unless clearly they've enjoyed the majority a while. An example I'll throw at you really quick is same-sex marriage, right? For decades, eons, conservatives have been able to use the power of marriage licensure to ensure that they could prohibit, you know, interracial marriages for a while, and then, of course, same-sex marriages as well. And they were comfortable with this government power. They praised it. They supported it. They defended it. And only when the cultural tides began to shift, only when different groups began to compete and wrest control of that power that conservatives long had, are conservatives now freaking out and even some considering, oh, maybe it's time to get government out of marriage altogether. But it's this very notion that the power is there and it becomes just the popularity contest whereby a majority imposes their views on the minority. And it's easier to convince the minority that this is unjust until too often, you know, the minority becomes the majority on one or more issues and suddenly they love it because, hey, we're in control and it's intoxicating and we can finally get our way. But we try and appeal to the people who recognize that this is a fundamentally unjust and immoral way of governing society. And really the approach is decentralizing and tearing away from government all of these purported authorities that allow for this type of gamesmanship to happen. I just think it's really messed up. And so back to your question about what do I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think we have to ask ourselves, are we comfortable with people going to jail or even dying as we see all of the use of force across the United States with police officers? Do we want people dying because of this policy? Would I be okay if my neighbor died because he disagreed with it? And that becomes a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah, what was so annoying about this whole gay marriage hoopla is people all of a sudden just love the government. They forget about all the dirty things they've done, and they just, you know, the White House was lit up in rainbows and everyone was just so happy, you know.
I agree with that. I'm concerned with myopia, right? Where or even the short attention span. People have a short-term or long-term memory, rather. They only have a short-term memory. And how often is it that people, it's, what's that quote? It's those who don't learn from the past are condemned to repeat it, right? And you can't really learn from the past unless you can remember the past. And I think that's where we get into the problem, where today we have, everyone has, you know, ADD and all these short attention spans and everything. And people can't, going back to the context, people can't remember. They don't understand in the context of history what this given issue is. Therefore, we're not going to remember the history. Therefore, we can't learn from it. Therefore, we repeat it. And it's just cyclical. It's happening over and over again. And we need people who have that institutional memory that can say, look, guys, we've been through this before. Can we try and, you know, try something else for once?
Yeah, I also noticed there's such a double standard where now it's like, okay, we celebrate, you know, gay and group marriages. But then when it comes to Mormon polygamists, got to come in there and shut them down, right?
Well, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. We've raised that argument. Of course, the you know, Mormon church hasn't done polygamy since 1890. There's some splinter groups that have. But in our history, right, it was the federal government coming against the Mormon church trying to impose a new definition of marriage with which everybody disagreed. And church leadership was sent to prison. People were going underground and evading law enforcement officers. I mean, it was a huge thing. The underground was this very real thing that people were protecting one another, especially church leaders, to shield them from prosecution. Wives weren't testifying against husbands. It was very difficult to enforce. So there was this huge freak out. And we, you know, so many of us here in Utah have ancestors who lived through that to either small or large degrees. And now so many are supportive of the government doing the exact same thing to other people. It's, again, it's one more example of not having the context and recognizing that, hey, if you disagreed with it when the government wasn't on your side, you shouldn't agree with it just because the government is on your side. You should disagree with it all the time to be consistent.
Do you think that Mormons are unfairly demonized? Because I hear all kinds of things about them, and I think, no, I don't think that's true.
Like any group, it's easy to mischaracterize what is said about us. It's funny, you know, I've written several books. I do a lot of speaking on these issues, and I encounter a lot of people who aren't Mormon, and the extent to which they know about Mormonism is, you know, from the South Park or the Book of Mormon musical, or you know, some Comedy Central clip or whatever. And so that, you know, I was a missionary for my church. That's why I was in Honduras for 2 years that I mentioned. And so, you know, spent a lot of time working with people, teaching people who were told that we believed a certain thing when that clearly isn't true. It's the same thing though, politically, right? People say, oh, you libertarians believe this, or I heard that, you know, anarchists think this or whatever. And whether it's politics, religion, or business or anything else, people have their biases. They have the limited information that's some purportedly authoritative source shared with them. So it's not confined to religion. I kind of get it in all aspects of my life. And I think we all do, right? We're used to people concluding things or believing things based on limited and in some cases incorrect information. Mormons or whoever, I think that's just human nature to think we know, but we don't know what we don't know. You know what I mean? We don't realize that we might have been given incorrect information, but we're just going off of what we were told as if it was true.
So would you think that anarchism would be good for the whole world? Is this like a globalist idea?
That's interesting to ponder, right? Because everyone says, oh, you know, anarchism, go look at Somalia and see how that's holding up, right? Yeah. So in a global context, that's the example that's always shared. But in reality, it's far from it. When you look at specific examples of what Somalia has been through, the prevailing arguments that are used actually are incorrect. And some of the arguments that aren't mentioned work very much in favor of voluntarism when you look at some of the indices and the metrics by which you can judge societal progress and health and everything. So yes, I think it's for everybody simply because I think it's the only moral view. I think ultimately government has to be through voluntary contractual agreement. Why do I think that? Well, what is government? Government is merely an organization of people, and that a group of people cannot delegate to an institution powers that they do not themselves have, right? I can't empower an agent, a third-party agent on my behalf to, you know, steal from my neighbor because I do not have that power myself. And yet governments have asserted that they have general police powers and that they're parens patriae, which is the Latin term for being father of the nation, that they are ultimately in control of all children and all people in the state. These legal doctrines have percolated, and yet it's in total opposition to what government itself properly is. Even many of the founders, Thomas Jefferson especially, right, he advocated for repeatedly ratifying the Constitution in each new generation so that you could actually have consent of the governed. We simply do not have consent of the governed, and therefore everything ultimately the government is doing is illegitimate. There is no way that those being governed today can actually consent. And even if you consider elections the method by which the governed can consent, you look at extremely low voter turnouts, and then even those who show up to vote, it's only a majority of people imposing it on everybody else. That's not consent of everybody who's governed. So even logistically, theoretically, conceptually, voluntarism is the only model that makes sense for moral governance in any sort of civil society. Otherwise, you're talking about empowering thugs to empower the will of the few upon the many, and I just think that's a bad model.
Well, what about a splitting up or secessionist idea of the country breaking up into different areas? Because some people actually want government. Some people want to be national socialists. Some people want to be anarchists. And I don't think that they're, you know, with almost what we're going to come up to 400 million people here, it's hard to have one system that works for everyone. So do you think that would be a potential?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I think that totally makes sense. Decentralization fosters experimentation and innovation. When you have top-down control, you don't have that. So look at a hot topic right now like Common Core in education. And you have all of these schools around the country being forced to change their education standards to this Common Core that's produced by an elite small group of insiders. It's never been pilot tested. It's never been psychologically evaluated. There's all sorts of problems with it. And yet it's being imposed on, excuse me, on everybody. What if instead you have had innovation and freedom, or as you point out, decentralization and even secession between schools, such that they could go different routes and things like Common Core or any of these novel concepts would not be enforced upon everybody, but would rather be subject to the market, right? So if you had secession, if the United States of America was broken up into 13, 15, 20, 40 countries, whatever, you could have different countries taking different routes and finding different ways of doing things. And suddenly those in the United States who see that, you know, their neighbor made these three tweaks in the Constitution and look how much freer they are now, that becomes an incentive for the United States to shape up. Otherwise, the citizens might move to another state. It's this whole theory back in the day of the 50 states being, you know, laboratories of democracy, even though democracy is an awful term. But in fact, a friend of mine often changes that one letter in that quote, and instead of calling them laboratories of democracy, he calls them lavatories of democracy, where you get the crappy end of things. But the whole idea was that you would have mobility between them, that if I live in Utah and things are just going awful, I can vote with my feet. And if enough people do that, like is happening right now in California, where I'm from, right? There's a mass exodus of people and companies from California because taxes are high, the drought's messed up, the government's messed up, education's messed up. That has an impact, at least in theory, and the bad actors can be punished, finally.
So what are your thoughts on leadership? I mean, Europeans have always had kings and leaders, role models, heroes, gods and goddesses. Are you opposed to a natural hierarchy?
You know, I think as a Christian, I believe Christ is king. In terms of human relations, I don't have any problem with that, whether in the animal order or the human order or whatever, provided that it's voluntary, right? Like, so I am the leader of my organization, but nobody is compelled to be my employee. But if they decide to enter into this contractual relationship and be my employee, there is a natural order because it is the way that this organization is laid out. And it's through contract that they are recognizing that maybe some of their free speech rights are going to be suppressed, you know, on company time or whatever, if it's contradictory to what our organization stands for. So through contract, you can, you know, suppress or abdicate some of your rights, and through voluntary association, certainly, I think we can build these, as you say, these natural order systems where we can delegate authority or recognize authority, much like the consent of the governed. The government could do awful things provided that it had the unanimous opt-in of everybody who was being governed, right? When I talk about that a government can only have powers that we ourselves have, that's in this system where you have majority control. But if you know, you're on an island with 10 people and all 10 of you want to vote to, you know, empower this new government to do something that you would not morally be able to do yourself, that's okay because everybody involved has agreed, that consent has been given, and therefore you can provide that power to that system. We don't have that today. And so provided that it's voluntary, consensual, contractual, I have no problem with leadership, with hierarchy, with any sort of non-flat system simply because people have opted in and they've agreed to whatever terms and conditions are involved.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about your book, Feardom. I know you discuss how politicians use fear, but this can also apply to, lamestream news, right?
Oh, not only can apply, certainly does apply.
Yeah. And it's what, six corporations own 90% of the news?
Yeah, no, it's total messaging. In fact, in the book, I point out a gentleman that many people aren't familiar with, Edward Bernays, who is the father of public relations.
We know who that is. Yep.
Yeah, you know, and here's a guy who, through his government experience being Woodrow Wilson's confidant, was able to hone a practice and paradigm that launched many careers, that launched basically changed government, changed industry. And now, you know, in political terms, it's called propaganda. But then when he went into private practice shortly after seeing what it had done in World War I and how public opinion could be shaped to such a large degree so affordably, went into the private sector and called it public relations. And, you know, all the marketing and PR we have today is a result of this concerted effort to and calculated and very statistically significant way by which people can change behaviors. And so, yeah, I think the media definitely can and does use fear. As I note in the book, you can have it in business, you can have it in religion, in politics, in family. Any attempt of one or more people to gain power over others, they can use fear to do so. And in fact, is a very effective means for doing so. And that's why it's so prevalent, certainly in politics, but also elsewhere.
Well, explain to us, how does fear work as a weapon?
So in the book, I explain in a bit more detail than I'll provide now, but there's actually a very scientific way by which this happens in our brains. There's kind of two pathways in our brains where information is routed, and one is more for processing, the other is more an emotional response. And when we have this, these emotional triggers, they fire faster basically than the processing circuitry does. And so what that means is you think of, you know, seeing a scared woman seeing a spider, and she has that emotional outburst where had she stopped to think about it, she would have recognized that the spider is far away. It's not going to jump. It's small. It's not a threat. And she would have been able to rationally process the information and act in a different manner. But instead, the irrationality takes power. This is actually a function of our brains in doing this. So the fact that it is natural and normal and scientific means that it can be controlled and exploited for people's benefit. That if politicians, media, whoever can find ways to get us to react emotionally, to get us to react in this kind of carnal, visceral sense without thinking, if they can get us to feel scared and feel that we need a protector, these type of things prevent us from thinking logically through whatever situation we're being presented. And so it's those circumstances in which what happens is they offer the problem, right? And they scare us into here's the issue. And sure. Then, of course, they're there conveniently to provide the solution.
That's why we also have to always double, triple check history. I like to read a lot of revisionist material because a lot of times the narrative that you're given is it's the bullshit one. You know, you need to do your own investigating. I mean, there's people being imprisoned for being revisionists right now. Did you know that?
Well, yeah, right. Isn't history written by the victors? And so certainly those who differ, I think, are not very popular with the prevailing regime, certainly.
But when it comes to Dylann Roof, what did you think when you heard the news and politicians speaking about him and the entire event that happened in Charleston?
You know, to be honest, this event didn't stand out to me too much than it did any of the other shootings that have similarly been capitalized upon by politicians. You know, what was her name? Amy, whatever the movie actress was in the news the other day and talking about how horrible it was that the recent shooting had happened. I think it's something that becomes so consistent that none of the shootings are really standing out from the others, because you always get the typical response that this is a horrendous shooting. This is someone who shouldn't have had guns. Therefore, we need to better control who has access. We need greater security measures. This is somebody who clearly there were warning signs. And so we need a greater, you know, Big Brother Minority Report-esque type of program to catch this stuff before it happens. I mean, it's over and over and over again. What's interesting to me with cases like this, and I've written a little bit about this before in one of my other books, and that is what you don't see in the media is all of the cases in which a weapon has been used successfully for self-defense.
Sure.
John Lott has written a lot about this, and he actually went through and did some studies looking through all these different newspapers and compiling word counts for figuring out how much ink was given to the anti versus the pro gun stories. And of course, you see right now everyone freaking out about the Charleston and the other shootings, and yet you don't see in the media all of the other, again, the events that would give context to the issue of guns, that would restore some balance so people could say, oh yeah, people do horrible things, but you know, that woman defending her children against that aggressor the other, you know, day was so moving to me. And so we need to make sure that she still has the right to do it. Those are entirely absent from the conversation, whether with Charleston or the other issues. And that's where my concern comes in, is that, yeah, there are concerns here that we need to address and that we can reasonably talk about. But I'm unwilling to do so unless people are willing to admit and at least include in the discussion the context of how these guns are saving lives, not just taking them.
Yeah, it's funny too, because of how he got a gun, there was just some loophole. Their computers don't update fast enough. So it's just really a matter of updating their computer system. You know, they couldn't see that there was a pending charge there. So it's like, okay, that's actually a simple problem that if you guys can go to the moon, I think you can solve that problem.
Of course, it's probably a funding issue and they'll ask for more money and, you know, but.
Well, I noticed just the barrage, because I really looked into this, of anti-white articles that came out after that. It was just like blatant racism towards white people. And now it's, okay, is there going to be some other government policy? So what do you think about government involved in race relations and affirmative action and all those other programs?
You know, the issue that I've had more familiarity with is all of the shootings that have been happening most recently, right? With us, many of the cases, white police officers shooting, you know, black people. And I'm from a criminal justice perspective, where we do a lot of policy work. It is concerning to see a lot of these policies really destroying black families. I mean, there's really no way around it. And in fact, there have been many prominent black people, Walter Williams especially, and many others, who recognize that this exact trend is happening, whether with welfare or guns or drugs or whatever. These types of issues ultimately have a disproportionate impact upon minority populations. And so, yeah, there's kind of reverse white privilege thing where we're all supposed to feel, you know, horrible for the crimes of our ancestors and make reparations and everything, which I really don't buy into. I don't think we're guilty of the sins of our fathers. But on the other hand, I mean, I think we do have to recognize that in our society, there is an imbalance. And especially the predominantly white elected officials can and do have the power to do something about it, because what's happening is that these minority communities are just suffering the brunt of so many of these policies. And I think that does need to be discussed, admitted, and frankly resolved. I think it's just tragic.
So what would you propose?
Great question. If I was dictator for a day, I mean, ultimately, when you look at it, some of the biggest drivers of the disproportionate criminal justice stuff is drugs. You know, a lot of these communities, they're dealing drugs, they're trying to get by, the economy is destroyed. You know, think of like Detroit, Michigan, where the police is just so dysfunctional now that there's private security firms. You want to talk anarchism? Here's a great thing, where private security firms are now offering police protection to residents at pretty affordable rates, and they're doing a great job. And these guys are patrolling the city, especially in parts where, you know, police can or won't go. And so it's been really interesting to see free market private actors coming in to compete against government in these places where government policies have really destroyed stuff. But I think ultimately it's the war on drugs. I think so many of our, you know, I'm very concerned also about how our prisons are filled with nonviolent offenders, how we have the largest prison population, both in terms of total numbers, but also per capita, than any other country in the world. And especially when you look at the racial lines, so many of these are drug crimes, they're low level petty type of stuff, and they're people of color, they're minorities. And, you know, no dictator in a day, myself or anyone else, can say, here's what's going to fix it. But a lot of times it is these types of drug crimes, these nonviolent issues that over the years, again, incrementally have led us to where we are. I do think it's going to take a while to get out of it, but I think the greatest way to stop or at least to reverse the trend is to stop the war on drugs.
So is it the fault of white people that non-whites are on drugs or a higher percentage in jail? Should we be egalitarian when it comes to jail sentencing?
No, I don't think it's white people's fault per se. I don't think it's the fact that they're white. You know, no one voted for these initial policies because, you know, we're going to punish blacks or we're white or whatever. It's just the ultimate result, from my vantage point, of what the policies have done. It's the consequence, whether it's a seen or unseen consequence. So I don't ascribe racial motive to these policies, but certainly there is racial disparity in their enforcement and execution.
Well, I want to ask you, should we allow drugs to flow freely? I mean, what do you think about the war on drugs?
It's an interesting question, right? Because people think that legalizing something oftentimes means sanctioning it. Right. The question, as you phrased it inadvertently or perhaps intentionally, of should we allow drugs to flow freely? I think of it in the reverse. I think of it as, should we incarcerate and even kill people for using drugs? Because that's the status quo. And I think those who defend any measure, any aspect of the current policy regarding drug use and possession, distribution, and everything else need to be put on the defense. The onus is on them to justify why we should be sending these people to prison, why taxpayers should have to subsidize, you know, sending these people to prison. In many cases, to become more aggressive and once released from prison, commit even more audacious crimes. So I don't think of it in terms of should we allow. I think we first need to ask, do we have the authority to prohibit? Certainly, as a parent of two children, you know, I don't want DUIs, I don't want drugs on the corner, I don't want any of this kind of stuff. But I think that if you look at other countries, especially like Portugal and elsewhere, who are recognizing that this is a mental health issue, this is an addiction issue, a public health issue. This is not a criminal justice issue. This is not something that prisons can solve. Prisons are not rehabilitative. If anything, it's exacerbating the issue when you're sending a low-level nonviolent drug offender into a prison population with many violent people. In many cases, these people are becoming even worse offenders once released. And so I don't think it's a question of should we allow. I think it's a question of we don't have the authority to deny. Certainly there are other steps that can be taken, whether through government or more importantly through the private market, to discourage and disincentivize the use and sale and distribution of drugs. But our current approach simply has utterly failed. $2 trillion full of prisons. You know, drugs are just as accessible as they ever were. I always tell people, you give me 5 minutes from now, I could find drugs. From five minutes, I could do it. And it's in schools. I mean, it simply hasn't worked. And yet the consequences have been so tragic for so many families. I think we can't hurt by starting to decriminalize and find a different solution. We certainly can hurt by keeping the status quo.
Yeah, I'm really surprised there hasn't been a tax revolt. I mean, I don't want to pay for these people in jail. I don't want to pay for wars. I don't want to pay for Israel. I don't want to pay for welfare. So
absolutely.
Where is the tax revolt happening? Why is that not happening, you think?
Oh, I've thought about this a lot, right? I love the story of Henry David Thoreau, who wrote the classic essay, Civil Disobedience. And for those who don't know, I'll very briefly relate the experience that led to him writing that. He was living at Walden Pond. Of course, he's famous for writing the book Walden about his transcendentalist experience of, you know, living in nature and everything else at the pond that was owned by his friend Ralph Waldo Emerson. But while they're living at the pond, he was walking around one day and he was confronted by a tax collector. And the tax collector demanded that he paid the tax for the Mexican-American War. And Thoreau objected to the war. He didn't like it, so he said, I'm not paying the tax. And of course, he was thrown in jail. He was bailed out, I think, by his mother or some family member. He only spent a night in jail. And yet that experience is what led him to think about, you know, when your conscience conflicts with the law, when is it okay to break the law? It's a very revolutionary essay. Gandhi, Martin Luther King, many other prominent actors committing civil disobedience have pointed back to.
He was a communist too, by the way.
Yeah, well, and I think his ideas have merit. But to your point, about objecting to tax. Back in those days, there were specific taxes for specific things. Everything now today is just a slush fund. And if you object to any one given policy, you have no way to reasonably dispute it because there's no precise tax for that precise action to which you object. And I think that's intentional. I think just having all these general taxes and just drawing out of general funds has really disincentivized any more specific protests because you can't really protest against a blob. It's just kind of hard to push back against.
Well, Connor, as we wind down, please tell us about Libertas Institute. You have some books, your website, and anything else you want to share.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate it. So Feardom, of course, is the most recent book talking about this longstanding trend of political fear-mongering. So the website there is feardombook.com, F-E-A-R-D-O-M, feardombook.com, and doing really well, endorsed by a wide range of people from the left and the right and everything in between. And that was intentional. I wanted to convey to people that this isn't a right-wing thing. We have the head of the ACLU endorsing the book, recognizing that, you know, There's validity in what's being said. And so that was intentional to convey to people that this is a systemic thing. It's not a partisan or a political thing at all. So Libertas Institute is a libertarian think tank. And so we are one of many state-based think tanks. So we operate in and focus just on Utah. But there's many similar organizations, whether conservative, libertarian, somewhere in between, in every state in the country, in fact. One way to find out for which organizations are in the state where you're at is go to spn.org. That stands for the State Policy Network. It's kind of the umbrella organization through which many of us are affiliated and communicate with one another. And then they have a little directory on there where you can look up your state and see who's there. But we focus on Utah, and we do a lot of stuff. We do parental rights. We do government transparency, education reform. Civil liberties has really become our bread and butter. We do a lot of stuff dealing with government surveillance, right to privacy, body cameras, forcible entry, surveillance, and all sorts of stuff. And in fact, with our work, Utah has become a leader among the several states in many of these issues, that with the legislation we've passed protecting people's Fourth Amendment rights, Utah now has some of the best laws on the books. And so we're actively working on trying to get other states to adopt those as well. So it's been a lot of fun. And you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is look for ways to not only affect Utah, but educate others more broadly. Probably the best way that we've done that so far is with a project that we did for little kids, or we're doing presently. It's called the Tuttle Twins, T-U-T-T-L-E, tuttletwins.com. And this is a series of children's books to help educate the rising generation about the principles of liberty. So we have two books out so far. One teaches about kind of the proper role of government from a classical liberal perspective based on The Law by Frederick Bastiat. The second book is teaches about the free markets based on a great essay by Leonard Reed called iPencil, talking about how, you know, nobody knows how to make a pencil. Even this simple object requires the collaboration of unseen, you know, millions of people working together to, you know, the logger needs a chainsaw, but the chainsaw manufacturer needs the metal, and the metal needs the trucks, and the trucks need the roads, and everyone's working together through spontaneous order to allow many of this innovation to happen. So that's another book that we've done. We're doing one right now based on G. Edward Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. So the kids will be learning about central banking and money and inflation and everything else. And we've had such a great response. And the interesting thing I'll note really quick is that when we first started these books, we figured the kind of general libertarian crowd would glom onto this the most because, you know, they've read the books maybe, so they want their kids to learn this stuff too. In fact, our greatest audience has been homeschoolers. And in many cases, these parents themselves they've never read, you know, Frederick Bastiat or G. Edward Griffin or anything else. They wouldn't call themselves libertarian. And yet, by virtue of the fact that they've decided to opt out of government education, they're independent-minded. They want to learn. They're hunting for this type of stuff. And so we go to like homeschool conventions, and these books just fly off the desk, off the table. It's been a lot of fun. So that's one of the projects that we're doing, TuttleTwins.com, to try and educate the rising generation, recognizing that in schools especially, these kids are not learning anything remotely connected to liberty. And so we want to provide that countervailing force and hope that, you know, that can pay dividends down the road. So trying to find fun projects like that to educate people more generally and build momentum for the cause of liberty.
Great. Well, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, what are your thoughts? Speak your mind in one of our comment sections. Let us know. Connor is a kind man, and so this is not an attack on him, but I wanted to share some of my thoughts. Libertarianism and anarchism is a white people thing. The philosophy of private property and liberty is a white man's philosophy. But what's missing? An allegiance, a love and a loyalty for one's own people, a respect for what our ancestors have created to carry on the traditions and culture of our people. That takes creating boundaries. In fact, they'll scoff and be confused when you say your people, because they're so removed from their own blood and ancestral soil that they don't even know where they come from. They see no value or sacredness in it. Just as many are in favor of private property for good reason, so should a nation have borders. Space is what allows a people to flourish. Without it, the flower will get trampled. Setting boundaries requires force. It's not voluntary. If our military only worked to enforce those borders, and if our government understood this idea, I would support them. Many anarchists seem to be okay with monoculture, globalism, and the blending out of all differences, but they aren't even honest with themselves about it. There's also this fear of boundaries, and so anything goes because we can't interfere. And no one can lead because that's hierarchy. They've given up on the idea of a benevolent king or leader. Yet what if Jesus showed up and ran for president? Would Christian anarchists support government then? Looking back, the entire time that I was talking about anarchism, the thought of race preservation and culture never occurred to me. I did not think about it. And sadly, this is the case for most libertarians. Some, yes, but few. That's why they can't see how free market capitalism, for instance, with businesses going overseas or making toxic products freely, is not good for their people, because they don't even think about their people. Force, order, and authority has its place in our lives. It's that concentration that produces excellence. It's funny how people who live in the whitest, safest places in America seem to be the biggest utopianists. I'm finding that many libertarians are simply liberals or cuckservatives trying to appeal to everyone. Politics and spirituality are very much connected, and until we are healthy spiritually, we'll never have a benevolent system. Thanks for listening. If you want to help support us, please sign up for a Red Ice membership to access all our programs. Visit redicemembers.com. Talk soon.